Let's recall our motivation and really treasure each moment that we have to practice, because we're not sure how many moments more of this precious human life there will be for us. Let's really determine to use our life wisely, and in particular to generate the renunciation of cyclic existence and the determination to be free. And in addition to that, loving, compassionate bodhicitta, aiming for full enlightenment to benefit all the living beings. So how are you? Yeah? Are you able to keep your mind here, even though there's just a couple of weeks left in the retreat? No, you're not? Your mind and your body are separated, huh? That's what they call death. Yeah? So your mind's gone back somewhere else?
I'm not going back, so, but just in general, the mind going out of meditation hall and stories and,
yeah,
you know, dragging it back.
Yeah, keep bringing it back. And remember how, you know, from the viewpoint of a 2-month retreat, the last 2 weeks seems like not very much. But from the viewpoint of a 2-week retreat, 2 weeks is a long retreat, isn't it? You know, when you sign up at to go to a cloud mountain, 1 week you're wondering if you could make it. So 2 weeks is a long retreat from that viewpoint. Yeah? So don't just kind of brush it off as, oh, we're almost over, but really use it. Okay? What else is happening? Yeah?
I've been spending the past week really... You know, it occurred to me about 3 weeks ago that I have rarely ever used the antidote the way in which they need to be used. Mm. And so I've really spent some time going over Balamrim and antidotes, and I've found that the one that works for me, and I don't even know where it's listed, is to cut it off at the pass as soon as it arrives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as soon as I feel some sort of agitation or some sort of unpleasant feeling in my body, because I get so hooked into the storyline so quickly,
mm-hmm.
that just saying, okay, stop right here. And I have found that to be an extremely powerful antidote.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, small annoyances or just getting attached to, you know, the thinking about, because during the retreat, a lot of things from my past have been coming up that I want to purify, but there's a temptation to get into the reminiscing and the people I wonder if they're doing now, I really like them, I really did like them. So to really just say, this is a purification practice, this is not a trip down memory lane. You know, so I'm really, because I really need to stop it really, really quickly when they arrive.
Yeah.
And that's really that third verse in the 8th verses of thought transformation.
Yeah.
That's a very, very powerful antidote.
Yeah. Okay, so you're finding that because you buy into the storyline so quickly, that when, as soon as you notice something going on, just to right away tell yourself, stop. Yeah, and not get involved in the storyline. Or if, like you're saying, you're doing purification because things from the past are coming up, then purify what you need to purify, but don't start remembering everything from your past and getting all into it, and what are the people doing now, and maybe I should go on Google and, you know, look them up again and find out what they're doing. And yeah.
The other thing that has been also a powerful antidote is just if I can just spend a moment and say, you know, you've been down this story before and it causes you nothing but suffering.
Yeah.
you know, the attraction, the seduction of the old way of thinking. Mm-hmm. If I can give myself enough time to come to my senses in the beginning there, then you know where this place that leads to a lot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I think actually that's a big thing too, is noticing that the old habitual mental states don't make you happy. And even though they're familiar and there's some weird, perverted kind of comfort in the familiar pain, that, you know, we want ourselves to be happy, so why just continue allowing ourselves to think like that? Actually, that relates very much. I brought this letter in from one of the inmates, and this relates to what he was saying. So let me see what he says. He says, I have a lot of anxiety, and I find it extremely hard sometimes to sit and do the retreat because my mind will just wander about, and I can't seem to get myself calmed down and relaxed. I'm very hyper at times. Do you have any advice I could use for these times? But I know none of you have that. Yeah. Okay, so this whole thing of anxiety, you know, I think that's a very interesting one, isn't it? You know, it's not specifically listed in the, you know, in the mental factors as we commonly read them. But it certainly is a positive state of mind, a potent state of mind. Because it comes so often, and just this kind of worry and ruminating. And it's funny how anxiety works, because sometimes, like maybe somebody said something to us, and then we start ruminating on that, spinning about that. Did they mean this? Did they mean that? What does that mean about me? Am I deficient? On and on and on. And that becomes anxiety, doesn't it? Because next time we see the person, we don't feel relaxed. Our mind's just all bubbling up with, you know, what do they think of me? Did I do something wrong? I don't know what I did wrong. How else am I supposed to act? You know, all this kind of stuff goes on. And it's just anxiety producing, isn't it? No? Or sometimes, rather than go on the past, we look to the future, and it's like, oh, I don't have a place to live, and, you know, I don't have a job, and I don't have any friends, and I have all this work I have to do by such and such a date, and I don't know what I'm doing, but it's got to be done. And how am I going to get it done? And what are people going to think of me if I do it? And what are people going to think if I don't do it? Yeah, so we get anxious about that. Yeah, and it's like none of this stuff is happening, is it, at all? It's just totally our mind just, you know, really creating quite a miserable reality for ourselves. So I think when we get into these kind of anxiety states, we have to just, you know, that what you just said, you know, immediately confront and avert it, because it's not going anywhere. You know, just recognize it's just my mind making up all sorts of things that have nothing to do with what's going on. You know, and it would be much more productive if I put my mind on developing renunciation. And actually, anxiety is a good thing to renounce, isn't it? You know, anxiety is very symptomatic of samsara. So you say, yes, anxiety is the nature of samsara. I want to get out of samsara. So you use it to develop renunciation. You use it to develop compassion for other beings and bodhicitta. Okay, so you turn your back on those mental states that are making you miserable. That is, unless you really enjoy being miserable and you have nothing else to do with your precious human life. You know, I was telling you when I was teaching in Seattle last week, something that happened when I was at my parents', because they have a dog, Jody the dog. So I take the dog on walks. Okay, so Jody, you know what she finds so interesting? Did I tell this on Thursday night when you were listening? No. Okay. So, you know what dogs find so interesting? The smell of other dogs' pee. You know, it's like the most fascinating, interesting thing in the world. So I'd be walking down the street and, oh, Jody catches a whiff and she goes over to this pole and sniffs and sniffs and I'm pulling, you know, on this thing and it, she won't budge. You know, it's this, the smell of this dog's pee is like so captivating and tantalizing and whatever, you know. And I would stand there and look at her and think, you know, here's a sentient being with the clear light nature of mind. Here's a sentient being with the Buddha potential, you know, who has the clear light conventional nature of mind, the empty ultimate nature of mind, and all this incredible potential. And look what all that potential is focused on single-pointedly. You know, the smell of dog's pee. You know, so from a human viewpoint, looking at what Jody gets all excited about, we go, wow, how silly, you know, and how tragic, really, when you think of it, of this being having the Buddha nature and then just focusing on pee. And yet, when we look at the things we focus on and get all wrapped up in, it's as interesting to Jody the dog as the dog's pee is to us. And, you know, for Jody the dog to think about all the things we get anxious and worry about, it's like so stupid. You know, who would worry about that? Yeah. You should worry about your dog food instead. Something useful, you know. Don't worry about what somebody thinks of you. Okay. So it's true, isn't it? Yeah. So I found it very helpful to think like that, you know. Like, what am I putting my focus on? And, you know, from some other sentient being's viewpoint, is it... You know, then I kind of have to laugh when I'm doing and also feel the tragedy that I'm putting, you know, all this potential on something comparable to dog's pee. So I think that's a very good antidote for getting rid of anxiety, don't you? Okay, other questions? Mm-hmm.
I have a question about a meditation that I have found in the mind training, the Great Collection. It's mm-hmm. the mind training of Guru Yoga.
Uh-huh.
And there's a particular step in it that I've never really done before, and I was wondering if you might be able to talk about it a little. It's the hollow body meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I always heard of that meditation in the context of it being a preparation for like meditating on winds and channels, which mm-hmm. is highest yoga tantra, which mm-hmm. I don't have. So I'm wondering, first of all, is it okay for me to try to do this meditation? Mm-hmm. And then, second of all, if it is, then how do I do it?
Okay. So you're asking about doing the hollow body meditation in the context of Guru Yoga. I would have to see what you read, because I've always heard the hollow body also similarly as a preparation to meditating on the channels, winds and drops. So I have to see it to comment.
Huh? I've been wondering about getting the object of meditation in focus. So, for example, when I'm thinking of meditating Buddha, I can zoom in and get details like his face. But, for example, if I look at you right now, I can see your face clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see your whole body clearly.
Mm-hmm.
In time, with practice, as a meditator, you get the whole image mm-hmm. absolutely clearly, mm-hmm. even though that's not how we usually see
mm-hmm.
in daily life.
Okay, so you're asking about the clarity of the object of meditation, mm-hmm. and you're saying in daily life, you might focus in on a certain aspect, see somebody's face, but you don't see the rest of their body clearly. So in meditation, what about, you know, are we supposed to see the whole medicine Buddha's body clearly, or just the face? You know, I think it depends a lot on what we focus on, okay? Because if you focus on the whole person's body, then you can get that somewhat clearly, and the background isn't as clear, okay? If you focus on the face, then the body isn't as clear. If you focus just on the eyes, then the face isn't as clear. So I think it depends on how you focus, you know, what exactly you're focusing on. So it seems to me that in developing this, you know, start with, you know, how they say, go over all the different features of the medicine Buddha, adding the clarity of each one to the whole image that you're getting, and then try and focus on the whole thing for as long as you can, you know, and if you lose it, start going over it again. Or if there's one part that really, you know, attracts you and it's easier for you to focus on, stay with that. That doesn't mean you block everything else out. You know, if you focus on medicine Buddha eyes, it doesn't mean that there's just two eyes and everything else is dark in the universe. You're still aware of everything else. Okay? So I think it depends more on how you focus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, what is the ideal size?
Are there
different
things? Yeah. Okay, so the ideal size, and here we're talking about developing shamatha, or calm abiding, you know, with the object in front of you. You know, they do say different things. Yeah, sometimes they say 4 inches, you know, or a hand span. Sometimes they say as small as you can get it. You know, when it's the Buddha on top of your head, sometimes they say a cubit, which is actually quite large. Sometimes they say smaller. So I think you use a size that works for you. They say that, you know, sometimes it's more helpful to make it small because it helps your mind focus if something's small. But I think sometimes it can also make your mind tight if you make it too small, because then your mind just becomes like that, you know. So I think, and sometimes it can be helpful if it's large. So I think you have to see what size works best for you.
I have one more question about this, and it might sound really silly, but I have to ask it. Mm-hmm. When the Buddha's on my head at the beginning of the sentence, I feel like if I'm going to spend time focusing there, I want to...
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Can we put him out here and know that he's still here?
Okay, so you feel like when the Buddha's on your head that you kind of want to twist your head and look up, and oh, there's a fan, right? What happened to the Buddha? So can you think of the Buddha out there but visualize him up here? No, I think you keep the Buddha up here. But I think, you know, what I find interesting about that is that it reminds us of how we seem to have this eye in there somewhere, don't we? There seems to be this reference point from whence we look at everything. And since our eyes are in front of us, it seems like the eye maybe is there, you know, right in front of us. And like when you're visualizing a mandala and you have to visualize the deities and back, it's like, you know, you want to turn your head. But no, you can be aware of things in back of you even though you're not seeing them. Okay, you can be aware of things in, you know, above you even though you're not looking at them.
So it's almost like you're developing the perception, you know, just tuning into more awareness around spatially.
Right.
I mean from a mental perspective, but it's still
And you begin to see that the whole idea of space is somehow very conceptual in some ways, isn't it? You know, because there's this me in the middle that's looking in the different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? I do that too with emptiness. I'm kind of in the middle and with vast emptiness all around me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not really empty, is it? There's a big me in the middle.
It doesn't matter the size. When I first start, the first few 15 minutes or so, it's vast. It's very large. But then it gets smaller and smaller, and I notice that I start kind of sighing and kind of going deep.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets quite small.
Mm-hmm.
Emptiness is very small. Is that normal?
you know, they use the analogy of space-like emptiness because space is kind of the closest thing we can think of that resembles emptiness in the sense that there's no obstructions. But emptiness doesn't have a shape, and it doesn't have a size. So you're not seeing small emptiness or big emptiness when you're talking about the emptiness of inherent existence.
Well, it seems like it gets more subtle, and I get more just kind of deep.
Yeah, you might get more focused, but it's not like your world is becoming smaller.
It looks like it.
Yeah. Like a little peephole. Yeah. Yeah. But see, that's the thing, is they say, you know, that emptiness is, we perceive emptiness non-dually. When you think about that, what in the world does it mean to perceive anything non-dually? Have you ever in your life perceived anything non-dually? Because whenever we perceive something, there's always the I perceive this. So it's not non-dual. Yeah? So I think, you know, kind of it's like, what in the world does that mean? You know, what would that be like to experience something non-dually?
So along with Dallas's question, like I always get confused when I'm visualizing the Buddha on my head and then I do the seven limb prayer and I visualize prostrating. It's like, do I prostrate towards myself from in front of myself to the Buddha on my head, or do I prostrate from where I'm at to the Buddha in front of me, or do I get up and turn around and
Okay, so when the Buddha's on your head and you have to prostrate, how do you do it? First of all, you imagine, you keep the Buddha on your head, but there is, you imagine all your previous lives in human form all around, and they're all prostrating to the Buddha that's on your head.
And so yeah. When I make offerings, I...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you can emanate goddesses, and then they make the offering to the Buddha.
I got confused at that point.
Yeah.
So this is object of meditation question too. So if I'm sitting there, I have the Buddha and the Buddha, and I have the mantra, and then I start sending light out to the being. And when I start sending the light out to the beings, of course, the more attachment to them I have, the more kind of sucked in, like, you know, the story. So then I go, oh, okay, I'll sort of stay away from, I'll just kind of lightly go, family. and then I go, okay, people in Afghanistan, you know. And that's a, you know, I don't get quite a suck there. I don't really know anybody. But pretty soon I'm into politics and why is me Georgia? And then I'm, you know, cutting that and I just am hopping around between this being the Buddha, the Buddha, the mantra, and these, and it's like every time I start sending the light out, I feel stuck into a story.
Okay. So every time you're the medicine Buddha sending light out, you get sucked into the story of, you know, what's happening in Afghanistan, if you're sending the light to Afghanistan, what's happening with your family, if you're sending the light to your family. Well, here you can see that your self-generation, you haven't dissolved yourself into emptiness. Oh, yeah. Because... it's not Kathleen Medicine Buddha, you know, it's Medicine Buddha. And those aren't your you know, they're all, well, all sentient beings are your family when you're Medicine Buddha in previous lives, but you have equanimity towards all of them. Okay, so you have to go back and meditate some more on emptiness. And when you arise as the Medicine Buddha, you are no longer Kathleen, you know. And Kathleen's family, there is, you know, there's no Kathleen's family. Yeah, there's Medicine Buddha and there's all the kind mother sentient beings who, as Medicine Buddha, you see equally. So maybe you also have to do, not maybe, but you definitely have to do some more meditation on equanimity.
Is there a way to do the visualization where you look at the whole mercy? The Buddha kind of head and you want to have Manjushri and Maitreya and...
Okay, when you visualize the merit field, it's always in front of you. You don't, you know, like in the Lama Chopa Puja or whatever, when the merit field dissolves, everything dissolves into Lama Lozen Tuwan Dorji Chang, who dissolves into you. And then you reappear as the deity. But when you reappear as the deity, you don't have the whole merit field around you.
So when we do the visualization with the medicine Buddha, there really wouldn't be a time where you visualize the whole merit field?
If you're doing the, not the Lama Chopa merit field, you wouldn't
meditate. No, just like, the one that we learned when we learned the Shakyamuni Buddha practice, and it starts out with the Buddha in front, and then he ends up coming on your head, and we always kind of have,
When we do the Shakyamuni Buddha practice, and you have the refuge visualization with the Buddha surrounded by all these other Buddhas, and then dissolves into you, you know, then you manifest as the Buddha, and afterwards, you know, and then if you're doing Lama Chopa, you visualize the merit field with Lama Tsongkhapa in the center and Manjushri and Maitreya and all that. That's in front of you, okay? If you're doing, let's say, Medicine Buddha, you would dissolve, and you're doing the meditation on the entire mandala of Medicine Buddha, then you appear as Medicine Buddha and you imagine the other deities in the mandala around you. Okay? But that merit field that we visualize for Lama Chopa and in the Shakyamuni Buddha practice, that's particular for that practice.
Okay?
Yeah. In each, like when you may have different merit fields and different practices according to the lineage of the lamas that are in that practice, and you know what else you're visualizing. Okay.
Speaking of the mandala, the mandala picture that you had, that we put, that we made the copy of.
Oh yeah, where is it, by the way?
It's in the Medicine Buddha book.
Okay.
So my question is there any correlation to the other, I mean, they all appear as Medicine Buddhas, to the Medicine Buddhas that we had created and visualized on our crown?
Those are the, in the mandala, those are the same Medicine Buddhas plus Shakyamuni Buddha, but they're arrayed, seated in the places in the mandala. And then you have all the yakshas and all these other beings.
Mm-hmm. So, you're saying the merit field is only when we do that specific practice?
No, there's a merit field that can be unique to each practice.
So,
and the merit field of the tanka in there, that's for doing the Lama Chopa Puja.
Yeah, so sometimes when we do like just three prostrations, you know, somebody will say, visualize the Buddha and the merit field. Is that all right, or?
Yeah, that's fine, because that's fine to do prostrations to that whole merit field, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in the, that would be the only time that I think.
Yeah. And it's good on each atom of the merit field, you visualize another merit field. So that there's infinite merit fields that you're prostrating to and infinite bodies that you're prostrating with. And don't worry, you don't have to see all of them clearly. You can just get the feeling of, you know, being, having them all around you.
Question about teachings and taking notes. I was reading in one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, and he was talking about, you know, listening, and he was very clear in that talking about it, that he suggested not taking notes, that
to be present for the Dharma and just to let it in kind of in that moment. So I'm just curious, I mean, for myself personally, I find that that writing, you know, is a different kind of medium and it kind of gets in a different way. But I also know that sometimes when I just listen, maybe I don't remember or can't refer back to it. But I do hear it in a different way, so I'm just curious if you would comment on it.
So the whole thing about taking notes in teachings, is it valuable or is it distracting or how does it work? I think it depends on the person, depends on the situation. Some people learn very well auditorily. Other people don't. They learn by written stuff. Another people learn kinesthetically. So you have to see how you learn best. You also, I found personally that I developed this little note-taking thing with all these abbreviations, and I found it to try and write down word by word what is said a very good practice for listening intently, you know, because I found that there's so many different ways of saying something, and if I hear it and can write it down exactly as it was said, I'm going to understand it in one way rather than if I hear it and just kind of reword it into what I think it means and write it down. Okay? So I found that particularly for myself very helpful. And also because when I started, there weren't very many Dharma books. And so if my teachers were going through, you know, 10 points, if I didn't write them down, I wasn't going to remember them. Yeah, now there's more Dharma books, you can go look them up. But then I also found that as I studied certain things and I began to know what those 10 points were, then to listen without taking notes, I heard it in a very different way because it gave a little bit more space for contemplation as I was listening to the teachings. So I think you need to see what works for you. Yeah? And I think this is also where it can be very valuable. You know, we now have the fortune of being able to tape things to, you know, that you might find that you might want to listen to it the first time without writing anything down and then listen to it another time and take some notes on it. And, you know, because there's different ways of listening. Sometimes you're listening just to get the feeling and the experience, but then if I ask you, you know, what are the 8 freedoms in a precious human life? And after, you know, 5 years of studying the Dharma, if you can't say, then it's going to be hard for you to do the meditation. Yeah? So at a certain level, there's, you know, some points that you have to memorize and learn. So... Yeah.
I have a question about the visualization, kind of going from general to specific, because it, you know, sometimes you can just go to all, just get to all the realms.
Mm-hmm.
But and also I read that in somewhere that you can it's good for the earth as well. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is that, you know, how specific can we get without getting hung up in stories like somebody's cancer particularly and going, is it all right to like be visualizing somebody that has cancer and going in their body?
So how specific to get?
Yeah.
And if you're doing Medicine Buddha for one specific person who has cancer, do you, you know, is that good just to focus on that one friend? And imagine the Medicine Buddha on their head and the blue light really going in their body and purifying and everything like that. I think it's always good, as much as we can, to make the visualizations expansive. You know, even if we don't have clarity on something. So even if you're doing it for one person and focusing on one person, still there's all the other sentient beings as far as space exists. Sitting around them, and they're also being purified with Medicine Buddha on their head. Okay? Because, you know, we do have karmic connections with certain people, and it's very helpful to do these practices and prayers, visualizing them particularly. But we also can't let our mind get so narrow, because then we start getting involved in attachment and stories and worry, and we forget all the other people who have cancer. Yeah, so I think it's good to always place things in make it bigger. I think it keeps our mind more balanced, include more sentient beings.
That's why sometimes I need a specific, and then I can go to the gym.
Right, yeah.
And another question about like when you're doing all six realms, I have difficulty with like the God realm. How do you be beneficial there?
Okay, so when you're trying to enlighten all the beings and the gods, how does that work? Because they have so much pleasure. But, see, this is where we are so hooked in to thinking that whatever somebody is now is what they're always going to be. The beings who are now born in the God realms, they're not going to always be gods. When that karma is up, you know, probably some negative karma ripens and they get born in the lower realm. So don't just think of those beings as, you know, always being that. Think of the, you know, they're still in samsara, they're still subject to afflictions and, you know, are reborn under the influence of karma. So there's still a lot to purify in their mind streams. And, you know, and really remember that beings go up and down and up and down in samsara. Samsara is very unstable. Yeah, I mean, beings are always dying, getting reborn, dying, getting reborn, and going from down to up and up to down. And yeah, and so I think it's, you know, thinking about that is so important to really get us to stop thinking that everybody is who they look like right now. Because this is the basis of all of our attachment, is we think that there's inherently existent people. And how they appear to us right now is who they always have been and always will be. But there's no inherently existent people. 100 years ago, I think, you know, it'd be very interesting if somebody here had the clairvoyant power of knowing, you know, the death and rebirth of sentient beings and could tell us the bodies and situations we were all in 100 years ago, you know, like in February 26th, 1908. Okay, where were we all? Okay, who were we all? You know, were any of us together in the same realm? Did we know each other in 1908? You know, or maybe we came from all different sorts of realms in so many vast places in the universe. So don't get hooked on to somebody being who they always are, because that's really the concept of inherent existence. Yeah. You know, and not to mention the concept of permanence, which is even grosser than grasping at inherent existence. So not a, you know, we're not who we are, who look like, and who we look like right now is so superficial. Yeah, it's so superficial. I mean, and I think it's just fascinating. DFF, you know, some years ago we all brought our baby pictures in. Now try and pick out which baby picture belongs to which adult. And then take your high school graduation picture and try and see which graduation picture corresponds with which adult. Very difficult. Very difficult. Have you ever been in people's homes and you see their pictures around the house? And like, it's hard to recognize who was who. Yeah? So don't just think that people are always, you know, even this lifetime, what this body looks like.
Mm-hmm. I think it was something we taught, but it might have been another teacher, that when you're thinking of the suffering in the God realm, when they start deteriorating a little because it's so perfect,
yeah,
they're shunned by all the other gods,
yeah,
because they don't want to know that there's deterioration.
Right. Yeah, there's different in the God realms, there's different level of gods. So in the desire realm gods, when they approach death, then their body starts to decay, their flowers wilt, and everybody else just totally shuns them. Okay. But for the gods in the form realm and formless realm, that doesn't happen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes that's why they are suffering so much in this country. Because they say, like, the suffering of those gods when they die is some of the worst suffering that exists.
Mm-hmm.
That always resonates with me when I think about all the stuff we have in this country.
Yeah.
And how unhappy we can be.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Completely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for me to imagine, I think it's probably beginner mind, well, not beginner mind, but that it's so much more fun for me to imagine like the God realm and the hell realm and the animal realm here on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and the conventional
reality. Okay. So you're saying that it's easier for you to think of the different realms as here on Earth because there's beings that you can see. You know, there's beings in the Beverly Hills God realm, and there's beings in the Baghdad hell realm. And, you know, so that is helpful. But again, I think it's really helpful to expand our view and get us out of thinking that this one little speck in the universe is all there is. Yeah? Otherwise we become so earth-centric. And this earth is like, you know, it's like just a speck of dust. And, you know, from our perspective, what happens here is like so incredibly meaningful and important. But, you know, how many different, you know, planets are there in this infinite space of the universe with human beings on them? And do we think about the suffering of those other human beings and those other little specks of dirt in the universe? You know, so it really puts us in touch with how everything that is in relationship to me is always more important than the rest of the universe. Yeah? And so I think especially to develop bodhicitta, we have to expand the mind. We have to go to other realms and other universes and all these countless beings. Yeah, really make the mind big. And it's very helpful for us personally because it puts our little speck of dust into perspective. Yeah? Uh-huh.
I love the way that it's so universal. I thought sometimes when the spacecraft lands, We'll be the only ones that will be greeting these creatures because they're really recognizing the sentient beings even meditate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the army will be out with the weapon. It'll be up to us to save them.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You asked a question about the emptiness in space. Is space just an analogy?
Space is an analogy, yeah, for sure. Space is not emptiness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Space is the lack of tangibility and obstructability.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the conventional phenomena. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were that easy to realize emptiness, boy.
Just go look outside.
Yeah, exactly. You know, or just space out. Now, space is just an analogy.
Do you think that the using computers a lot kind of has an effect on your mind?
Everything has an effect on our mind. Yeah, if we use computers a lot, it affects our mind. If we handwrite a lot, it affects our mind. If we ride motorcycles a lot, it affects everything affects our mind. So then the thing is, how does something affect our mind? And how do we let something affect our mind? Yeah. And what I personally see in terms of computers is that it is very easy for us to keep sentient beings at a distance and not engage on a human level, because all we do is, you know, we don't have to talk to them, we can just write them a note. Yeah. And then talking to them involves more engagement. And then actually sitting in the room with them is even more engagement. And this is what concerns me about the younger generation in America, where they all go to their rooms and have their own computer, who learns social skills? Yeah? And how to tune into other living beings. Yeah. On the other hand, the computer can really put you in touch with beings that you never even would normally remember exist. And so, you know, if you see it in that way, it expands your mind to so many other beings. Yeah?
I have a question, but just real quick. I have a really good friend who has, he's 17 now, year old son. But she was just telling me how they had to shove him out of the house and lock him out of the house when he was 13, 14, 15, 16, to get him off the computer and stop chatting with his friends and see them face to face.
Yeah.
And she said, all of the parents are like that now. They literally go outside.
Right. You know, there's a school in South Korea for kids who are computer addicts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have another visualization question. In visualizing the nature of our mind, you know, clarity and awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I see that differently than emptiness. It has a luminosity.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like one plane of a crystal in my mind. It just has a slight luminosity.
Yeah. Now, you know what's really tricky with all these things is we use analogies to understand them. So, you know, clarity and awareness is sometimes luminosity and awareness. So then we think luminosity, like light. Light isn't the mind. Yeah? Light isn't the mind. The mind is without form. So there's no color, light, or darkness, or shape. Our mind, here you see how much we are oriented towards form, towards matter. You know, that because we don't want to visualize the clear and knowing nature of the mind because it's not a form. There's nothing to visualize. Yeah, it's just clarity and knowing and how hard it is for us to get in touch with our basic experience of having a mind because we're so outward focused. Yeah, but to sit back. And what is cognizing without visualizing luminosity or space or anything? What is cognizing? How do I know this thing that's cognizing? How do I, you know, how is there cognition of clarity and awareness? Yeah, because it's not a visualization of some kind of, you know, sparkling luminosity or something. Yeah? So you really see here how our mind works and how it's very difficult to turn the mind inward, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah, and to remember that analogies are only analogies. They're not the reality of the thing. They're just given to help us understand something. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the three principal aspects.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how much this is going to help my meditation or practice, but it just bothers me every time I read it. So, this is appearances clear away the extreme of inherent existence. Emptiness clears away the extreme of non-existence.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the antidotes were the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I thought emptiness cleared away the extreme of inherent existence, and appearance cleared away the extreme of non-existence.
Okay. Yeah. So usually, you know, when we initially meditate, the realization of emptiness stops the grasping of inherent existence. And the realization of dependent arising and appearances stops the thing of non-existence. Okay? But here, it's... let me see the line again. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So when it says appearances clear away the extreme of inherent existence, what this is meaning is that things don't inherently exist, but they do exist. How do they exist? As appearances, dependently arising appearances. Okay? Things are empty, but they're not totally empty of existence. They're empty of inherent existence. So it brings us back from the extremes.
So how come they're using the antidote switch there rather than what we normally use in that?
Because appearances clear away the because what it's getting at is that emptiness and dependent arising come to the same point. Okay.
So they're, as antidotes, they are interchangeable between each other.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. When you get to the point in your practice where, you know, both emptiness and dependent arising can oppose both extremes, then you see them as emptiness and dependent arising as complementary and not contradictory. And then you're really sure that you've understood things properly.
That's why the last line says, as long as these two things
are separate. That's right, you are not now. Yeah.
Okay. I think since I've gotten here, I've been reading that line and being like, what? Backwards.
Yeah, right. Well, if you think of it as, you know, and here this is just an analogy, but if you think of inherent existence over here and total non-existence over here, okay, well, when you meditate, how do you counteract inherent existence with emptiness? You know, how do you counteract non-existence with dependent arising? But then, if you think about it a different way, if these are the two extremes, how do you bring yourself in? Well, instead of inherent existence, you have dependent arising appearances. Instead of total non-existence, you have emptiness and inherent existence.
They're relative then to what you're trying to use as an antidote, but because they're both the same thing.
Yeah, they come to the same point. And that seeing, you know, what that verse is helping us do is to really see how they come to the same point. Yeah? And to especially, after you perceive emptiness directly, to still be able to establish conventionalities afterwards. But to establish conventionalities without grasping at them as inherently existent. And then when you meditate on emptiness, to counteract grasping at them as inherently existent, to not fall in the extreme of total non-existence and nihilism, but to see no, only empty of inherent existence, or dependent arising. Sure. Good question. Okay. Let me...